ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th Canto, Chapter 14. Text 4 is up there, but it doesn't have a purport, so I'll chant that, Sanskrit and English, and 5 as well, and we'll do 6 together. Okay. So ya jaj raja suyena vijit... No. Simon says, right? You know, I'll chant 4 and 5 myself and read the English translation. We'll do 6 together. Okay. So yajad rajasuyena vijit yabhuvana trayam patnim brihaspater darpat taram namaharad balat. Translation. After conquering the three worlds, the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems, Soma, the moon god, performed a great sacrifice known as the Rajasuya Jagya. Because he was very much puffed up, he forcibly kidnapped Brihaspati's wife, whose name was Tara. Text 5. Yada sadeva guruna yachito bhikshnaso madat nat yajat tat krite jagne suradhanava vigraha. Translation. Although requested again and again by Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods, Soma did not return Tara. This was due to his false pride. Consequently, a fight ensued between the demigods and the demons. Okay, now 6. We'll do this one together. Sukro brihaspater dvesad. Sukro brihaspater dvesad. Agrahit sasuro dupam. Agrahit sasuro dupam. Haro guru sutam snehat. Haro guru sutam snehat. Sarva bhuta ganavrata. Sarva bhuta ganavrata. Sukro brihaspater dvesad. Agrahit sasuro dupam. Haro guru sutam snehat. Sarva bhuta ganavrata. Yeah, others. Vaishnavis. Okay. Vaishnavis? Sukra, the demigod named Sukra. Brihaspati, unto Brihaspati. Dvesat, because of enmity. Agrahit, took. Sa Asura, with the demons. Udupam, the side of the moon god. Hara, Lord Shiva. Guru Sutam, the side of his spiritual master's son. Snehat, because of affection. Sarvabhuta Gana Avrita, accompanied by all kinds of ghosts and hobgoblins. Translation. Because of enmity between Brihaspati and Sukra, Sukra took the side of the moon god and was joined by the demons. But Lord Shiva, because of affection for the son of his spiritual master, joined the side of Brihaspati and was accompanied by all the ghosts and hobgoblins. Purport. The moon god is one of the demigods. But to fight against the demigods, he took the assistance of the demons. Sukra, being an enemy of Brihaspati, also joined the moon god to retaliate in wrath against Brihaspati. To counteract the situation, Lord Shiva, who is affectionate towards Brihaspati, joined Brihaspati. The father of Brihaspati was Angira, from whom Lord Shiva had received knowledge. Therefore, Lord Shiva had some affection for Brihaspati and joined his side in this fight. Shrida Swami remarks, Angira sasakshad prapta vijo hara iti prasid. Prasida. Lord Shiva is well known to have received knowledge from Angira. Om aginatam anam dasha jananjana shalakaya chakshudam ilikam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanam anobishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayam upagadam mayam dadati swapadam tikam. Just going to reread these three translations here. After conquering the three worlds, the upper, middle, lower planetary system, Soma, the moon god, performed the great sacrifice known as the Rajasuya Yajna because he was very much puffed up. Because he was very much puffed up, he forcibly kidnapped Brihaspati's wife, whose name was Tara. Although he was requested again and again by Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods, Soma did not return Tara. This was due to his false pride. Consequently, a fight ensued between the demigods and the demons. Because of enmity between Brihaspati and Sukra, Sukra took the side of the moon god and was joined by the demons. But Lord Shiva, because of affection for the son of his spiritual master, joined the side of Brihaspati and was accompanied by all the ghosts and hobgoblins. Okay. So we have a situation here where this personality, Soma, is behaving in an outrageous, totally outrageous manner. Let's analyze here. He's kidnapped the wife, okay? First of all, who is he? Soma is not just like any old Joe Smith or something like that, you know? He's not just a demigod or like an Upadeva, sub-demigod or a demigod. He is the predominating deity of the moon. And he's a highly placed personality. Predominating deity of the moon, okay? And he's kidnapping somebody's wife. And not only is he kidnapping somebody's wife, but whose wife is he kidnapping? Yeah, he's kidnapping the wife of the spiritual master of the demigods. And as we mentioned, he's one of them. So this is like really outrageous. I mean, he's just shot through the ceiling here on this one. This is totally outrageous. And And on top of that, even when his spiritual master, you know, Brihaspati, approaches him and tells him, hey, this is ridiculous. This is outrageous. You can't do this. He just immediately returned my wife. He refuses. I mean, even Bill Clinton, when he was caught, you know, having an affair, okay, he tried to deny it, but he didn't say, I'm continuing, you know what I mean? At least, this is, you got to, sometimes, you know, because we hear all sorts of really far out things as we're studying the Bhagavatam, and sometimes it just kind of goes like water for, you know, it just kind of goes right past us. We think, oh yeah, just another far out thing. I mean, far out in the sense that like amazing, spectacular. But it's important to stop and think about these things too, you know, because Sukadeva Goswami, he only had 7 days to instruct Maharaj Prakriti. He couldn't elaborate upon everything. He couldn't fluff out everything. He left that for the succeeding generations. So that's the job of the reader of the Bhagavatam, to really, you know, meditate on what's the impact, what's the significance of this? Because this is pretty amazing, you know, this kind of behavior. What else? He's refusing to give her back, and then he has to be, we haven't got to this part yet, but in a couple of verses it's going to explain that, how he was severely chastised by Lord Brahma, and then he, of course, you know, Lord Brahma's in a position way, way superior to all the other demigods. I can't think of an analogy off the top of my head, but, you know, there's like, he's like head, I mean, he's way above the other demigods in terms of power, in terms of intelligence, in terms of longevity of life and everything like that. So when Lord Brahma came into the picture and he told, you know, he chastised, what's his name? Soma, yeah. Then there was no question of like fighting with Lord Brahma or anything like that. Not on his level. You know, he had to return the wife and to, you know, immediately to Brihaspati. But then even again, after that, when she was returned, Brihaspati could understand, oh, she's pregnant. You know, she's pregnant. So he demanded her to deliver the child immediately, which she did. And then when the child was born, then there was a fight between Soma and, what's his name? Brihaspati. Whose child was it? You see? So in other words, he didn't even have, you know, after doing all that abominable activity, you think he just would have said, well, you know, out of feeling embarrassed, or, you know, okay, it's your child, you know. No, he got into another fight about that. So anyway, he's way off. I mean, as far as this goes, I mean, this is like, you could expect this kind of behavior from, you know, like Hiranyakasipu or Ravana. You know, this is the kind of thing you expect to hear happening from one of these kind of personalities. Not somebody who's a demigod and is the predominating, you know, deity, predominating deity of the moon like that. Very, shocking. Shocking. Shocking, yes, but at the same time, not really, what's the word? It's shocking in one sense, but in another sense, when you really study the Bhagavatam carefully and you really understand what's going on in this universe, then, and when you really have a deep understanding of the Vedic perspective, then it becomes less shocking. You know, it becomes less shocking because actually these kind of things happen. Yeah. Anyway, so I think an important question to ask then is what, you know, as always, is what do we learn from this? You know, what can we learn from this incident? A number of things. One was how powerful sex desire is. That's this personality, because, you know, obviously he knew he was doing the wrong thing. I mean, you don't get to be the predominating deity of the moon and not know right from wrong. He knew he was doing the wrong thing. But, as Krishna says, Arjuna asks in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that famous exchange where Arjuna asks, Atakena Prayukto Yam Yogam Shadati Purusha Anichanapi Varshnaya Balad Iva Niyojitaha. He said, by what is one forced to act sinfully, even unwillingly, as if impelled by force, something like that, you know. And Krishna said, Kama Esha Krodha Esha Rajaguna Samudbhava Mahasano Mahapapma Vidyanam Yavaranam. That is lust. Lust and lust only, Arjuna, which is born in contact in the material mode of passion and then gets transformed into wrath. And this is like a classic example here of that, which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. And, you know, we can see here's a classic example of what Krishna is talking about in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. This personality, this poor guy, he was overwhelmed by lust, And then he still couldn't control his mind. Even when he was pulled up on the whole thing by his spiritual master, he still couldn't control his mind. And rather than just go, oh, I'm so sorry, I apologize. Oh, my God, how did I do that? You know, oh, I can't believe it. No, he got angry, and he's fighting. He fights against his spiritual master, knocked down, drag out kind of a battle here to defend his position, which was wrong in the first place. So now we can see what Krishna was talking about. You know, in case you were wondering, what's Krishna talking about in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita when isn't he making a big deal out of nothing? No, he's not making a big deal out of nothing. It's that powerful. And there's so many other examples, and which we've been hearing as we've been working our way through the Bhagavatam, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month. We hear stories. We've heard about how Lord Shiva captivated by Mohini Murti. That's a little special, of course, but you know, we heard so many different examples of this same point. So that's one lesson we learned from this. Just how powerful lust is. So, you know, the caution is, be careful. Be careful. You don't want to mess around. You know, we don't want to mess around with this because it's just so powerful. That's why, you know, it's said, I think it was Jagyavalkya in his rules about Brahmacharya. He gives these different things. You know, it's Brahmacharya means not just that you don't engage in sexual intercourse. Brahmacharya means that you don't, I can't remember in order, but that you don't look at, you don't think about, you don't talk about, you don't, you know, nothing. It's kind of like, it's not like you can dibble dabble and, you know, play around, but I just won't, okay, but I won't fall down. Nuh-uh. It doesn't work like that. You know, now I'm thinking. Krishna says in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, he explains how careful you got to be. He says, "Dhyayato vishayan pumsam sangat sangateshu bajayate sangat sanjayate kama kama krodat bajayate." He explains how it works. Okay, if you want to become free from this, you know what you heard about here, you can't just start. Well, okay, I'm just not going to engage in the activity. No, Krishna explains that you got to start from the contemplating. He says, by contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment for them. From such attachment, lust develops. From lust, anger arises. From anger, bewilderment of memory. When the memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost. And when you lose your intelligence, you fall down again to the material pool. See, so in other words, if you want to not become victim of this lust, as we hear, you know, Soma here was, you got to nip it in the bud, which means you got to not contemplate. Jayate vishayan pumsam. If you contemplate the objects of the senses, then the next thing's going to happen. You're going to develop attachment for them. And then if you don't still yet, when you realize, hey, I'm attached, if you don't stop then lust is going to develop, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a sequence. It's a machine. This material nature is a gross and subtle machine, and that's part of that's the software. You see, you mess around with the software, nobody wins. You play with fire, you get burnt. You don't know, you know, you're going to lose. You see, so if you're contemplating the objects of the senses, you are going to develop attachment. And when you become attached, then the next thing is lust, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. See, so if you want to not be, in the same position as Soma, sooner or later, you got to stop the contemplating. That's the thing, okay? So that's lesson one. Another lesson we learned from this is if you were thinking that, well, I just got to make it to Svargaloka and then I can, you know, enjoy a nice peaceful life with my wife and children, and you got to do better than that, because obviously we're learning from this that, you know, and so many other stories we've heard that even in Svargaloka there's problems. You know, there's problems. It's not, you know, hunky-dory up in Svargaloka. It's not like everybody's well-behaved and in the mode of goodness. I mean, there's a lot more mode of goodness in these upper planetary systems than what there is here on Earth, but it's not pure mode of goodness, and these kind of things happen. Not just to, you know, the average, as I said, Joe Smith or John Doe or something like that, but even to the very highly placed personality. So, you know, because as devotees, we know that, but just good to mention and throw it out there that we have to set our aims at something higher than just being elevated to the higher planetary systems, because we'll be disappointed there too. You know, you're not going to be perfectly happy there. Another lesson here is pacifism doesn't work. You know, I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 1951. So, you know, I grew up as a teenager in the 60s, and the Vietnam War was happening at the time, and there was a very strong sentiment against war, you know, why war? You know, why do we have to, you know, we, no, it's enough, no more, no fighting. Like, yeah. It was, you know, it's in one sense it was good, but the reality of the situation is, in this material world, you need government. You know, you need government. You need cops. You need police. You need armies. Why? Because there's always going to be somebody who's misbehaving. There's always going to be somebody who's not, you know, going to be conduct themselves completely in the mode of goodness, observing, you know, religious principles or rules and regulations, and is going to, you know, step out of line, and they got to be dealt with. That's just the reality of the situation. And the proof of that is, look, it's happening here in the heavenly planets. What to speak here on Earth? It's happening in Svargaloka. And it's not just, as I said, some little, you know, Upadeva or something like this. This is like, you know, Soma, predominating deity of the moon planet. So it's just reality. You got to have police. You got to have armies. Krishna says, and there's nothing wrong with that. Krishna says in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Balam Balavatam Chaham, Kamaraga Vavarjitam, Dharma Varuda, Dharma Avaruda Bhuteshu, Kamosmi Bhattatarsava. He explains that I am the strength of the strong, which is devoid of passion and desire. Dharma Avaruda Bhuteshu. So, in other words, so if strength is used to uphold religious principles, that's good. That's good. And Prabhupada would say that repeatedly in his lectures. All, you know, like, for instance, if you give that example of a scalpel. If you take a scalpel and you have it in the hands of a surgeon, then it's, is it bad? You know, if a surgeon uses a scalpel to perform a surgical operation to save somebody's life, that's good. You know, the scalpel is not either good or bad. That's the point. If it's used properly, then it's a great thing. It could, you know, save somebody's life. If a rascal gets it, you know, some sort of unscrupulous person gets his hands on a scalpel, he can use it to cut somebody's throat, rob somebody and kill him, like that. You see? So it's just how it's used. So, some, you know, violence, for instance, in this case, that type of controlling people, it's not necessarily a bad thing if it's done with the right motivation, by the right people with the right motivation. So that's another lesson we learn here. Another lesson we can learn from this is that how important it is to, this is related to the first lesson, how important it is to control our mind. Because just look at all the problems this person is causing, what to speak of to himself, to everybody else, simply because he couldn't control his mind. Because as is described here in the verse we chanted together, now there's going to be a big fight, you know? And it's not that just Soma and Brihaspati stepped outside and just, you know, took care of this, dealt it with it themselves, with each other. No, everybody's getting dragged into this, you know? Soma is dragging in, Brihaspati, first of all, Sukra, because he was an enemy of Brihaspati, he joins with Soma, they're both demigods, and then somehow or another, Soma gets all the demons to help him. And then Lord Shiva is seeing the situation, feeling, no, this is not right. This is not right. And he had affection for Brihaspati because he received knowledge from his father, Angira. So he's siding with Brihaspati. And there's going to be a big fight here. And, you know, when you have wars like this, people get hurt, people get killed. So, of course, it's on a superficial level that you could say, well, you know, this is like so many innocent people are going to get, you know, damaged here because of this, because one person can't control his mind. So many other people are getting sucked into the whole thing. Of course, on another level, there's no such thing as an innocent victim, right? There's no such thing as an innocent victim. Everybody here in this material world is just getting exactly what they deserve. It's hard not, this is a hard one to swallow, but this is our philosophy that, you know, when you people who are not engaged in devotional service, whatever's happening to them, tsunamis, earthquakes, this, that, the other thing, It's karma. It's karma. So once again, the follow-on lesson we learned from that is that we got to get out of this material world. You know, you can't expect, it's always going to be problems here in this material world. If you know, you're always going to be caught up in some problems. Either you're going to be directly the person who's responsible for it, or you're just going to get caught up in somebody else's. Karma is there, and as long as we're here in this material world, there's going to be these kind of situations that we're going to be involved in. So the only real solution is, as we all know, get out of the material, go back home, back to Godhead. And hearing about things like this should be a very strong motivation for us to do like that. Because, you know, it's like when I read something, I just think, man, I don't want to know. I just feel like I don't want to be like, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to know anything about all this. You know, it's like, why do I have to be in that? I kind of feel, hearing about this kind of stuff makes me feel like, a little bit like embarrassed that I'm here in this material world. You know, I think a devotee should start feeling at some point, I'm embarrassed even being here. It's like such a ridiculous kind of place, you know, where even, you know, the very highly placed, powerful people behave in such a ridiculous way. So, you know, could be an impetus for us to just try to, you know, be serious about our devotional service and wanting to get out of here. Get out of the material world, go back home, back to Godhead. And so we should strive to, really take shelter of Prabhupada's instructions. And this doesn't have to happen to us. It's a caution. We hear about it. But, we're also told that if we just chant 16 rounds and follow the four principles, you know, just follow the basic program that Prabhupada's given us, it shouldn't happen to devotees. This shouldn't happen to people who are, you know, participating in the Krishna consciousness movement. I mean, It's good that we hear these things anyway, but at the same time, we shouldn't find ourselves in this position at any time, in the present or in the future, because of the knowledge that we've been given by Srila Prabhupada. So it's very it's a great responsibility for members of the Krishna conscious movement to follow this process, you know, take this philosophy seriously, follow the process seriously, because this movement is meant to it's not just meant for like this one generation and then that's it. You know, when the Prabhupada disciples pass on, then that's the end of it. You know, gradually everything will just kind of go, you know, diminish down to nothing. No, that's not what's supposed to happen. This is a movement that's supposed to be for next 9,500 years, and it's supposed to, you know, help a lot of people all over the world. See, so in order for that to happen, realistically speaking, that means everybody's got to understand we've got a responsibility to practice seriously, you know, and to help this movement continue on. If senior devotees don't practice seriously and they fall down, what happens is people who are like, you know, congregation or people who are aware of our movement, they won't take us seriously, you know. They won't take us seriously. You know, I'll give you an example. This is my own perception and may not be 100% accurate, but I'll throw it out there. Hopefully I know what I'm talking about. I've noticed about among Indian people, you know, Indian people have, you know, this is their culture, and they naturally have some affinity for, you know, these ideas and this way of life. But they've observed, over the years, they've observed. And because they saw so many, you know, Prabhupada disciples have difficulties, spiritual difficulties, and fall down, they haven't participated anywhere near as much as they would have if that hadn't happened. They, you know, they're still respectful, but they kind of it distances them. They keep more of a distance. They set up their own temples. You know, they open their... that was always something that bewildered me, you know, because when we started this movement back, I joined in 73. What to speak of Indian temples, there were no Indians. You know, there were no Indians in America practically. I don't remember seeing Indians. I've never seen one. I had a younger brother there were hardly any. There were hardly any. And so when they started coming and they started showing interest, if we were up to the standard, you know, then they would have just, ISKCON, they just would have become part of ISKCON and, you know, or a lot more so, and things would have developed like that. But, you know, because of different things, discrepancies that were there, they, you know, just saw, well, you know, it's good that these people are doing this, and it means we could do it, and we'll set up our own things. And it's kind of developed along those lines. So anyways, you get the idea. It's very important that the older generation, you know, the Prabhupada disciples, show a very good example in their own lives, because that inspires the younger generation. If they don't see that, then they won't take it seriously. I just, one quick anecdote that kind of like sticks in my mind as an example is, I remember one year, I think it was about 1989, 1990, I went to Vrindavan for Kartik, the only time I ever did. And so I was in the temple room in the morning. It was Mangal Arati, and there was a lot of other senior devotees there, way senior to me, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Satsarup Maharaj, Romapad Swami, this one, that one, this one, that one. You know, all these senior people were there. So I was thinking, and then Mangal Arati finished and Tulsi, you know, Puja was about to begin. And I was thinking, okay, you know, this is like, you know, like a spiritual holiday, so I don't have to come to the whole morning program. I'm just going to pay my obeisances and leave, you know, because I figured, it's a break. I'm not on Sankirtan. I'm not, you know, back in the West doing my service. I'll, you know, cut corner a little bit. So I paid my obeisances, and I came up, and as I came up from paying my obeisances, I was getting ready to leave. I looked around. There was Tamal Krishna Maharaj. You know, he wasn't going any place. There was Satsrup Maharaj. He wasn't going any place. There was Ramapad Maharaj. He wasn't going any place. And I can't, you know, as I said, there's like another half a dozen senior people to me, way senior to me. They were there and they weren't going any place. I thought, and I just had to stop. I couldn't do it. I just stopped and went, well, who the heck do I think I am? Where am I going, you know? I mean, who do I think I am that here's all these, my seniors, and they're taking this seriously, and I'm skipping out on it. I had to stay there. I just felt like, you know, social pressure. You see, so it works like that. It works like that. You know, so the senior generation has to show that example of, you know, and which so many of our senior people are doing, showing great examples in different ways, you know, of going out on Harinam, of coming to the program, of taking book distribution seriously, of taking the deity worship seriously. And if we do that and continue to do that, the next generation will take it seriously. If we don't, I don't think there's much hope that they will. You see, that's one point. And another point, you know, sort of following on from this point, is that we have to, the senior people, generation, we have to be thinking of passing the baton. Everybody knows what a relay race is? Okay. Well, the most famous relay race probably is the 400 meters or 440 yards like that, you know, quarter mile. And the passing the baton happens, there's four runners, okay, and each runner does a lap of the track, which is one quarter mile, and then right towards the end of his lap, he has to pass the baton. And they get, and this is what's called the zone. It's about 10 meters long. And in that zone, the runner who's just completing his lap has to successfully put that baton in the hand of the next runner, and then he just grabs it and takes off and he runs his thing. So, you know, that's ISKCON's like that. It's a good analogy, you know. It's a relay race. In other words, it's not ending with this one generation. We got to pass. Now we have to pass the baton on, and you have to be careful. You know, when you pass the baton on, I don't know if you ever has anybody here ever run in a relay race. Practically everybody at one time or another in summer camp or something, right? So you know what it's like. It's you got to do it properly. You can, if you're not careful about the whole thing, you can drop the baton. You know, you can lose a lot of time, and then you lost the race. You see, so you got to really, you know. It's an important part of the race, transferring that baton from the hand of the one person to the next. You see, it has to be. You have to think about it. You know, they practice that. You know, I've seen the guys. You know, because we distribute a lot of books at school, so I've seen. You know, you walk past the track and you see the runners practicing passing the baton. So it's very important. That's what has to happen. It has to happen. You know, sooner or later, and certainly within the next 20 years, probably sooner. You know, and that's important. Because otherwise, how's things going to, you know, go on into the future like that? And one last thought is, and this is kind of like, might sound a little mundane, but it's, I don't think it is really. It's at, you know, it's on the point of the importance of, you know, following, practicing seriously and staying enthusiastic about the basic practice of devotional service. sometimes... you know, we're here in a city, and we spend a lot of time. I don't know how I'm going to lead into this exactly. It's important sometimes to do what you got to do to stay enthusiastic. There's one purport in the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam where Prabhupada, he wrote it actually. It was kind of like a purport that was dedicated to Madhavisa Prabhu, late Madhavisa Prabhu. After he had some difficulty maintaining sannyas, and Prabhupada was concerned. He loved Madhavisa a lot, and he wanted to make sure he wanted to encourage him to stay, continue being a devotee, continuing practicing devotional service, staying in the association of the devotees. And he wrote this purport where I can't quote it verbatim, but the gist of it was that, you know, if somebody's not strong in one ashram, let them go to the other ashram. You know, but the idea is, under no circumstances, give up the fight and go away. You know, what's a good situation for one person may not be a good situation for another person. And Prabhupada made the point, the general principle was that everybody has to make sure they're in a situation where their senses, where their mind, where their body, you know, where they feel like they can fight. Because this is a fight against Maya. Prabhupada, you know, says repeatedly, engaging in devotional service is like declaring war against the illusory energy. So you got to feel like you're in a situation where you got what you need to fight against the illusory energy. Part of that is being healthy. So the point I wanted to make was, sometimes I've experienced this living around the temple. You might experience what's called ashramitis. Ashramitis is when maybe you're doing everything right, but you're just feeling a little bit under the weather somehow or another. And sometimes it's a good thing to do is you need to get out and have some exercise. As I said, it might sound a little mundane, but it's really not. Sorry, it's really not, because just like if you expect to get fruit from a tree, you got to take care of the tree. You're not going to get very good fruit from an unhealthy tree or a dead tree. So in the same way, that's an important thing. Srila Prabhupada didn't talk about it, but he did it. He did it, And why didn't he talk about it? Because he knew how much already everybody was, inclined towards a material way of thinking and living. And if he encouraged it, well, we'd have a Hatha Yoga society on our hands, practically. I mean, there's that one famous anecdote where he was walking down the beach. I don't know if it was Juhu Beach or where it was exactly. Where? Hawaii. Okay. And so the devotees were walking, and they saw some man doing a headstand. And so the devotee said to Prabhupada, "Prabhupada, look at that mudha. Look at that mudha, standing on his head." And Prabhupada said, mudha means fool or ass. And Prabhupada said, "No, that is not foolish. That is sirasana. That's very good for health." And so immediately the devotees asked, "Oh?" They were kind of surprised to hear Prabhupada say that. They thought, because, there's so many purports throughout Prabhupada's book, starting with the Bhagavad Gita, where you hear him criticize, Hatha Yoga is just gymnastics and foolish waste of time and so forth and so on. So anyway, so the devotee said, "Prabhupada, but isn't, Prabhupada said, "That is not the nonsense. That is sirasana. That's good for health." So the devotee said, "Prabhupada, so should we do that?" And, then there was no response. And walking. And then after walking for, a couple minutes, it was the end of the walk, and Prabhupada was at the car, and the devotees opened the door to the car for Prabhupada. Prabhupada's right at the door, and he just, before he got in, he turned around, and he said, "Not required." And he turned back around, got in the car, and then he drove off. In other words, he wasn't going to encourage it. He wasn't going to encourage it, because he knew, what would happen. But at the same time, Prabhupada, for as long as he was able to, he did a walk. Right here in Los Angeles, this is a place that was, he did it all over the world, but everybody knows the famous morning walks down at Venice Beach, etc. You see, so Prabhupada did it. He took a walk every morning. And in addition to that, Prabhupada had two massages a day. He had a massage before lunch that lasted minimum 1 hour, and the same thing before going to sleep. So he didn't talk about it, and he had his reasons for that, but he did it. So we can understand it's important. It's important to do. And, so just, it's just a suggestion. If you're feeling a little bit of ashramitis, a good way to get rid of that is we're actually in a very fortunate situation here in California. We've got good weather practically all throughout the year. If you can't do it in the morning because your service doesn't allow, you might be a pujari, whatever reason, just sometime during the day, grab your bead bag or throw a set of headphones on, just head to the east, and you got two good hills there. Within 1 hour, you could at least get up to the top of one of them and come back. You do that every day. Within 1 month, you'll feel like a different person. I mean, that's been my experience. So I just wanted to share that, with everybody for their benefit. And I've been doing that with Bhakta Jai Kush since Balaram Purnima. And his scores have just, we're going to get the official graph from Mayapur. But actually, since he's begun doing that, his scores have just kind of been going like that, just, getting better. Because why? Because he's feeling better. He's got more energy, feels healthier, feels more relaxed, feel more happy. And, you do better devotional service like that. So if it's done properly, once again, it's just like that example with the scalpel. If it's used improperly, well, it's not a good thing. If it's used properly, it could be really a good thing. So in the same way, if you do it properly, balanced in a balanced, intelligent way, it's a very good thing, to stay healthy and everything. And if you do it, if you get fanatic about it and get too absorbed in it, of course, that's not a good thing. It's going to take away from your devotional service. Okay, so I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions? Archie de Babu.
Haribo, thanks for an information-packed class. Two things. First thing is Yogyavalkya. You couldn't remember that verse, but it's very important since we have so many brahmacharis. It appears in a purport in the sixth chapter. I don't remember when, but it's karmana manasa vacha sarva vastasu sarvada sarvacha maituna tyaga brahmacharya pachakshase. He's defining what is a brahmachari. By your work, by your mind, wherever you are, in all times and circumstances, no connection to sex life. Very, very difficult platform to maintain, but at least you should know what you're aiming for. And then the second thing I wanted to touch on was your claim or insinuation that the Indians went away because there were problems in ISKCON. That may be partial. You said because there were problems in ISKCON, people falling down, that's why the Indians left and formed their own temples. But that's not 100% true.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it's probably not even 50% true. Part of it is just envy, plain old material envy. They got to the point where they couldn't stand that ISKCON was leading the Indian community and they wanted to do their own thing. I'll give you a perfect example. I was in the Potomac Temple in the mid-90s. There, it was originally a 16-acre farm. You know, you've been there. But they were having financial difficulties. So they got permission from the GBC to sell 2 acres. So they sold to this Indian guy. And, you know, he was a nice guy coming to the temple and everything. Anyway, they sold him the 2 acres. Literally, within a year, he became so envious, he opened his own temple in his home next door. And because he knew what the Indians are looking for, he had everybody on the altar. Shiva, Ganesh, this and that. Because he knew that was the way to attract them. So it wasn't nobody fell down at the temple during that time period. Nothing like that happened. He was just envious. Couldn't stand that all these people were coming to the temple, and he wanted to feel like an important person. So he formed his own temple next door.
Okay. If you remember, I prefaced that point before I introduced it, as I wasn't so sure about this one. So we could throw that one out. But anyway, the point's there that we have to, you know, the senior devotees, we have to show this good example. Otherwise, you know, that's to inspire the next generation. We have to show a good example. That was just to support that point, but probably it wasn't the best example. So, Vasubhu?
Hey, we should also understand that Srila Prabhupada gave us a Vaishnava philosophy, and most Indians were not familiar with Vaishnava philosophy. They've never been in contact with it. And so when they did come in contact with it, it was very foreign to them. So it took many years for them to even become warmed up to ISKCON. And in the meantime, you have Swami Narayan followers. They're the ones that are building probably 50-60% of the temples in America, if not around the world. And they're from a different thought, different philosophy. So yeah. Basically, you know, you have a situation where Srila Prabhupada came to America to make American devotees. You know, he came here for that particular reason. So, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily that they left because of what happened to us, but they were never really familiar with what ISKCON was about anyway.
John, Archer wants to say something.
Because if you use your logic, then they wouldn't follow any Vedic principles. Look at what happened in this case, Soma. Look at what happened with Brihaspati himself. What to speak of Indra. If you're going to use fall down as an excuse, then you wouldn't follow the Vedic principles at all. Because, like you said, even the demigods are falling down. So that's not an excuse for not following.
Okay, bad example. Sorry. Anybody else, anything? Yeah, Mata. I'm going 5 minutes over because the kirtan went 5 minutes over. So, that's okay.
Thank you very much for a very nice question. You mentioned about ashramitis. It's funny you should say that because I remember when I was in Toronto a couple of years ago with my Guru Maharaj, he did not like us staying in the ashram all the time. So one morning he took us all out on a walk. And I wanted to mention a comment that I saw a video of my Guru Maharaj. He says, if you go out and do a little exercise, he says your brain will start to think differently. So if you're inside all the time, you know, your brain's not going to stay fresh. If you go out and get a little air, you'll be a little bit more fresher.
Yeah. That's my experience, and I've seen that. I'll tell you one classic example that just real quick from another devotee. This devotee used to be here. His name is Charu Chandra, and he was a fabulous book distributor. He was actually like Sankirtan leader for a while, and he was he had a very athletic body. You know, he was really well built and everything. And he was feeling like super like lethargic and run down and everything. And one day I told him, you know what? Your problem is you're just not getting any exercise. He couldn't understand it. When I said, you're not getting exercise. Because we were going to the airport at that point. And our activity, our daily program, was just going from one building to another. You'd wake up, you come from the ashram to the temple room, from the temple room to the prasadam room, from the prasadam room to the van room, you know, like the van you drive out there, from the van inside the terminal, you see, and then back to the ashram, you know, back to the restaurant and to the ashram. And you'd probably be outside like maybe, you know, total, maximum of like a half hour throughout the entire day. So he was just, his energy was just going down, 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 down. And I said, you know, Prabhu, I just used to look at his body. I said, no, that's not right. That body needs exercise. So I told him, you need some, and at first he said, you didn't. But I got him to go to this Culver Plunge and sign up to learn how to swim. It's something he already always wanted to do. And within like a few weeks, even shorter, to be honest with you, he just blasted right out of that whole mode. You know, it was, in other words, I sized it up correctly. I was right. He just needed that stimulation because, you know, he had a young athletic body. And as soon as he started doing the swimming and a little bit of other things that he used to do before he's a devotee, he started feeling 100% better. And, you know, he went on from there. He left that behind. Yeah, Bhatsal Prabhu. That's a good point. I don't remember. Well, it is. Actually, Prabhupada said there's one comment. Yeah. Yep, I'd say that's probably a superior way to deal with the whole situation. There's one comment, I can't remember, Prabhupada was talking in Vrindavan, and he was talking about the Gurukul kids, and they were, actually, I think it was a discussion about what about exercise for the Gurukul kids in Vrindavan. And I don't know if Prabhupada made the point, or if another devotee made the point, and Prabhupada confirmed that when they chant and dance in kirtan, he said that is very great exercise. So, yeah, probably if you just somebody does that enthusiastically and wholeheartedly, that, you know, I don't, to be honest with you. So, yeah, that's why, you know, that might do the trick. Okay, thank you very much. Grunter, Srimad Bhagavatam, Kijai, Srila Prabhupada, Kijai.